You are listening to AfterSight. This recording is intended solely for individuals who are blind or have low vision.
Hello and welcome to the Colorado Business Digest with resources including coloradobiz.com, the Denver Business Journal, and denver7.com. Our first article is titled, Owning a Home More Affordable Than Renting, dated February 14, 2025. Adam Data Services has released its 2025 Rental Affordability Report, which shows that owning a home in the United States is more affordable than renting a three-bedroom property in more than half the county-level markets around the nation. The report shows that both owning and renting remain difficult for average U.S. workers, commonly consuming 25 to 60% of average wages. Owning is more affordable choice for those who can manage a down payment, despite median home prices generally rising faster over the past year than average rents around the country. The analysis for the report incorporated data compiled by Adam on average rents as well as median home prices from public record sales deeds in counties with sufficient single-family home sales data. Those two data sources were combined with average wage figures from the Bureau of Labor Statistics. Buying or renting a home in the U.S. these days can be like searching for a diamond in a pile of marbles, and it's only getting worse in most markets as the cost of both goes up, said Rob Barber, CEO at Adam, in a news release. However, in most parts of the country, home ownership is somewhat more attainable for those who can gather the necessary resources to cover down payments that often surpass $200,000. He added that the current situation is tenuous, especially if mortgage rates keep going back up like they have in the past couple of months. But for now, home ownership is the more viable choice. Median prices for single-family homes have increased more over the past year, or declined less than the average three-bedroom rents in 2025, or 66% of the 341 counties analyzed in the report. Counties were included in the report if they had a population of 100,000 or more and sufficient single-family home sales in 2025, along with sufficient data showing changes in three-bedroom rents from 2024 to 2025. The most populous counties, where median home prices have risen faster or declined less than the average three-bedroom rent over the past year, are Los Angeles County, California, Cook County, Chicago, Maricopa County, Phoenix, and San Diego County and Orange County, California. The largest among the 116 counties in the report, 34%, where changes in average three-bedroom rents have outpaced shifts in median prices, are Harris County, Houston, Tarrant County, Fort Worth, Bexar County, San Antonio, Suffolk County, outside New York City, and Franklin County, Columbus, Ohio. Significant differences in the affordability of owning versus renting exist among various regions of the country, with buying a residence most favorable in the Midwest and South, followed by the Northeast. About 80% of counties analyzed across the Midwest and 60% in the South, owning requires smaller portions of average wages. The same is true in about half of the Northeast. The West, meanwhile, stands out as the one region that bucks the trend. In that part of the U.S., rentals are the financially easier choice. Renting is the better option in about 80% of Western markets. The report shows that major home ownership expenses require more than one-third of the average local wage in 231 of the 341 counties analyzed for the report. But that pattern also varies widely around the nation. Only about a quarter of Midwestern counties, which have some of the lowest home prices in the U.S., fall into that category. In other regions, more than one-third of the average wages are needed in 66 to 98% of county-level markets. The next article is titled Commentary, The Importance of Beneficiaries on Financial Products. This is an opinion piece and does not necessarily reflect the opinions of AfterSight or myself. In the realm of financial products, beneficiaries play a crucial role in ensuring that the assets and benefits accrued are transferred efficiently to intended recipients. Let's discuss the significance of beneficiaries and explore the various options available, with a particular focus on bank products. A beneficiary is an individual or entity designed to receive the proceeds of a financial product upon the account holder's death. The presence of a beneficiary ensures a smooth and streamlined transfer of assets, eliminating the complexities of probate and providing peace of mind to the account holder. Beneficiaries can be designated for a wide range of financial products, including life insurance policies, retirement accounts, investment accounts, and bank products. Bank products, such as savings accounts, certificates of deposit, and individual retirement accounts, offer the option to designate beneficiaries. This feature allows account holders to specify who will receive the funds held within the account upon their passing. The TOD designation is used to name a beneficiary. TOD stands for transfer on death, the death of the owner of the asset. The primary beneficiary is the individual or entity who will receive the assets or benefits upon the account holder's death. It is essential to specify the primary beneficiary clearly and keep the designation up to date to reflect any changes in circumstances. A contingent beneficiary is the second recipient who will receive the assets if the primary beneficiary is unable to do so. Including a contingent beneficiary ensures that the assets do not become subject to probate if the primary beneficiary predeceases the account holder. Account holders can designate multiple beneficiaries and allocate the distribution of assets among them. This allows for customization based on individual circumstances, such as dividing assets equally among children or designating specific percentages to different beneficiaries. A trust can be named as a beneficiary, providing additional control and protection over the distribution of assets. By utilizing a trust, account holders can specify detailed instructions on how and when the funds should be distributed to beneficiaries. Beneficiary designations on financial products, including bank products, are crucial for ensuring a smooth transfer of assets and benefits to intended recipients. By understanding the importance of beneficiaries and utilizing the available options, individuals can safeguard their loved ones' financial well-being and alleviate potential complications during challenging times. Our next article is titled, Breakfast is Booming at U.S. Restaurants. Is it also contributing to high egg prices? Dated February 13, 2025. It's a chicken and egg problem. Restaurants are struggling with record high U.S. egg prices, but their omelets, scrambles, and huevos rancheros may be part of the problem. Breakfast is booming at U.S. eateries. First Watch, a restaurant chain that serves breakfast, brunch, and lunch, nearly quadruples its locations over the past decade to 570. Eggs Up Grill has 90 restaurants in 9 southern states, up from 26 in 2018. Florida-based Another Broken Egg Cafe celebrated its 100th restaurant last year. Fast food chains are also adding more breakfast items. Starbucks, which launched Egg Bites in 2017, now has a breakfast menu with 12 separate items containing eggs. Wendy's reintroduced breakfast in 2020 and offers 10 items with eggs. Reviews website Yelp said 6,400-plus breakfast and brunch businesses opened in the United States last year, 23% more than in 2019. In normal times, producers could meet the demand for all those eggs, but an ongoing bird flu outbreak, which so far has forced farms to slaughter more than 145 million chickens, turkeys, and other birds, is making supplies scarcer and pushing up prices. In January, the average price of eggs in the U.S. hit a record $4.95 per dozen. The percentage of eggs that go to U.S. restaurants versus other places, like grocery stores or food manufacturers, is not publicly available. U.S. Foods, a restaurant supplier, and Cal Maine Foods, the largest U.S. producer of shell eggs, did not respond to the Associated Press's request for comment. But demand from restaurants is almost certainly growing. Foot traffic at U.S. restaurants has grown the most since 2019 for morning meals, according to market research firm Circana. Pre-lunchtime hours accounted for 21% of total restaurant visits in 2024. Breakfast sandwiches are the most popular order during morning visits, Circana said, and 70% of breakfast sandwiches on the U.S. menus include eggs. Eggs Up Grill CEO Ricky Richardson said breakfast restaurants took off after the COVID pandemic because people longed for comfort and connection. As inflation made more food expensive, customers saw breakfast and lunch as a more affordable options for eating out, he said. The growth in restaurant demand reverses a pattern that emerged during the pandemic when consumers tried to stock up on eggs for home use, but restaurants needed fewer of them, according to Brian Ernest, a lead economist for animal proteins at CoBank. Changing preferences since then have caused further market strain. Americans are increasingly looking for protein with few added ingredients, and eggs fit that bill. Consumers think eggs are really fresh, so if you're making something with eggs, you know it's fresh, Ernest said. To address animal rights concerns, McDonald's and some other companies have switched to 100% cage-free eggs, which limits the sources they buy from. 10 states, including California and Colorado, have passed laws restricting egg sales to products from cage-free environments. It makes the market much more complicated than it was 20 years ago, Ernest said. The higher prices are hitting restaurants hard. Wholesale prices hit a national average of $7.34 per dozen last week, according to the U.S. Department of Agriculture. That was 51% higher than at the beginning of the year. Wholesale costs may be higher than retail prices, since grocers use eggs as a loss leader to get customers in the door. Some chains, like Waffle House, have added a surcharge to help offset the cost of the eggs. Others may turn to egg substitutes, like tapioca starch, for some recipes, or cut egg dishes from the menu, said Phil Kafarakis, the president and CEO of the International Food Service Manufacturers Association. First Watch president and CEO Chris Tommaso said eggs are critical for the chain's brand and are found in the majority of its offerings, whether at the center of the plate or as an ingredient in batters. So far, he said, the company has been able to obtain the eggs it needs and isn't charging extra for them. First Watch is also increasing portion sizes for non-egg items like meat and potatoes, Tommaso said. Richardson of Eggs Up Grill said he recently met with franchisees to discuss adding a surcharge, but they decided against it. Eggs have always been and will continue to be an important part of American diets, Richardson said. Our next article is titled, Joann Moves to Close 500 of Its Stores Across the U.S. Amid Bankruptcy, dated February 13, 2025. Struggling fabric and craft seller Joann plans to close about 500 of its stores across the U.S., or more than half of its current nationwide footprint. The move, announced Wednesday, arrives amid a tumultuous time for Joann. Last month, the Hudson, Ohio-based retailer filed for Chapter 11 bankruptcy protection for the second time within a year, with the company pointing to issues like sluggish consumer demand and inventory shortages. Joann previously sought Chapter 11 in March 2024 and later emerged as a private company. But after operational changes continued to pile up, Joann filed for bankruptcy again in January. It's now looking to sell the business and maintained in a filing Wednesday that closing underperforming locations is necessary to complete that process. This was a very difficult decision to make, given the major impact we know it will have on our team members, our customers, and all of the communities we serve, the company said in a statement sent to the AP. But right-sizing our store footprint is a critical part of our efforts to ensure the best path forward. Joann currently operates about 800 stores across 49 states. The initial list of the roughly 500 locations it's looking to close can be found on the company's restructuring website. Spanning states including Arizona, California, Colorado, Florida, Georgia, Illinois, Michigan, New York, Pennsylvania, Texas, and more. When exactly those closures will take place and how many employees will impact, it has yet to be seen. Joann's Wednesday motion seeks court permission to begin the process. Joann's roots date back to 1943 with a single storefront in Cleveland, Ohio, and the retailer later grew into a national chain. Formerly known as Joann Fabric and Craft Stores, the company rebranded itself with a shortened Joann name for its 75th anniversary. Both of Joann's bankruptcy filings seen over the last year arrived amid some slowdowns in discretionary spending, notably with consumers taking a step back from at-home crafts, at least relative to the early COVID-19 pandemic boom. Joann has also faced rising competition in the craft space from rivals like Hobby Lobby, as well as from larger retailers like Target, who now offer ample art supplies and kits. And while Joann turned to implementing a new business plan after emerging from bankruptcy last year, unanticipated inventory challenges post-emergence, coupled with the prolonged impact of an excessively sluggish retail economy, put Joann back into an untenable debt position. Interim CEO Michael Prendergast noted in a sworn court declaration filed when Joann initiated its latest Chapter 11 proceedings on January 15. Prendergast explained that inventory shortages had significant ripple effects on Joann's core business, particularly when in-stock levels eventually dropped by upwards of 10% and led to a new phase of operational distress. Citing these and other macroeconomic challenges seen in the retail space over recent years, Joann has maintained that a sale of the business is the best path forward. The company says it has proposed a stalking horse bid agreement with Gordon Brothers Retail Partners. Our next article is titled, "Trump Tariffs Rattle Small Business Owners Already Dealing with Tight Margins," dated February 12, 2025. President Donald Trump's continued rollout of a wide array of tariffs is rattling small business owners already dealing with tight profit margins. Trump on Monday announced a 25% tariff on steel and aluminum and promised more import duties to come. Last week, the administration imposed a 10.10% tariff on Chinese goods coming into the U.S. Sandra Payne, owner of Denver Concrete Vibrator, imports steel and other raw materials for her business. Her company makes tools to settle concrete and other industrial tools. Most of the steel the company uses comes from China, and she gets material from Canada and Mexico too. Small businesses run on very small margins, and so a 25% increase in any product is going to hurt, she said. And we can't just raise our prices every time the cost goes up to us, so we are losing a lot of money. In addition to the steel and China tariffs, other tariffs on Mexican and Canadian goods have been put temporarily on hold, but they could be implemented later. So, small business owners still need a strategy for mitigating the cost of the tariffs if they go into effect. Across the border, Julie Bednarski-Malik runs a snack company, Healthy Crunch, based in Mississauga, Ontario. She sells her products in both Canadian and U.S. retail stores and said she might have to raise prices depending on how the tariffs unfold, but she's still in wait-and-see mode as tariffs loom. I know that this is going to come into effect, but we're still unclear exactly the timing and the percentage of what sort of commodities are going to be impacted, she said. We hope that, you know, the U.S. and Canada could work together to find some sort of resolution, because we are such close allies and trading partners. Bar Zachheim owns a Better Place Design and Build, a contracting business in San Diego that specializes in building accessible dwelling units, or ADUs. He said he's especially worried about lumber. This stuff has already been getting more expensive over the past few years due to supply chain shocks and wildfires, and a huge proportion of our lumber comes from Canada, he said. These tariffs are going to make everything we do considerably more expensive at a time when the high-priced housing market and high interest rates are already cutting into our bottom line. Payne, of Denver County Vibrator, added that the tariffs will likely have a domino effect. I sell to other businesses. I don't sell to the end user. So everything that happens to me is going to happen all the way down the line. It's going to impact everyone down the line. Our next article is titled, Construction Comes Out of 2024 Stronger, But Labor Shortages Persist. Dated February 11, 2024. The U.S. construction industry ended 2024 in a firmer footing. However, skilled trade shortages were still a challenge, a report showed. The Royal Institution of Chartered Surveyors and American Association of Cost Engineering said construction was in a stronger position at the end of 2024, according to the USA Construction Monitor report. Researchers credited the infrastructure, home, and office sectors for growing in contracting activity. The Construction Sentiment Index, made up of different key indicators, climbed to plus 40 in the last quarter, the report showed. Confidence was higher at the end of the year compared to plus 19 in the third quarter and plus 25 in the quarter before that. The report counted net balance data on a range from minus 100 to plus 100. Infrastructure had an exceptionally strong plus 63% net balance figure, up 34% in the third quarter, the report showed. Energy pulled the infrastructure subsector the most, with a 69% figure for workloads. In 2024, the U.S. government invested in energy throughout the year, with a wide array of construction projects involving renewables, batteries, and nuclear facilities, researchers said. Housing and office projects also saw growth last quarter, with private residential developments a net positive at plus 26 in the fourth quarter compared to plus 10 in the third quarter. Non-residential development, including offices, was at plus 31 compared to plus 8, the report showed. Clients showed an interest in projects also ticked up, which led to better project expectations in the future, researchers said. Margins for confidence and profit entered a net balance of plus 4%, up from minus 13% in the third and second quarters of 2024. Despite the construction building in a positive direction, survey respondents noted that skilled trade and labor shortages continued to be a challenge. A New York said they were concerned about an aging workforce and the need to attract fresh talent in the industry, researchers said. Around 40% of built environment workers and professionals will retire within the next few years, researchers said. In the report, nearly 70% of respondents said shortages of skilled trades were an obstacle for construction activity. The runner-up was general labor shortages for nearly 60% of respondents, data from the report showed. The U.S. construction economy continued to gain traction in the fourth quarter of 2024, with infrastructure projects fueling growth and project backlogs reaching their highest levels since 2022, said Michael Cobia, the CEO of AACE, in a statement. While U.S. contractors are seeing strong demand, the ongoing skilled labor shortage remains a critical challenge that could impact future capacity. The data shows that the new administration's policy agenda must address skilled workforce shortages in the U.S. and control the cost of construction materials to sustain this momentum and meet the industry's long-term needs. Our next article is titled, Judge Blocks Colorado Springs Recreational Marijuana Repeal Effort, Calling It Unconstitutional, dated February 11, 2025. Colorado Springs' plan to ask voters to repeal recreational marijuana sales 6 months after they approved it by a wide margin is unconstitutional, a judge said Monday. Siding with two residents who filed a lawsuit against the city last month, Fourth Judicial District Court Judge Hillary Gurney issued an injunction to block the city from asking voters on an April 1 ballot to repeal Question 300, the ordinance to legalize recreational pot sales by existing medical marijuana dispensaries that passed by a 22,300 vote margin in November. Under Amendment 64 of the Colorado Constitution, local ballot measures to prohibit the operation of licensed recreational marijuana businesses may appear only on a general election ballot during an even number year. Our next article is titled, How Small Businesses Are Embracing Artificial Intelligence. A recent survey found 58% of small businesses across the U.S. plan to invest in AI. Dated February 16, 2025. As artificial intelligence plays a larger role in everyday life, small businesses are navigating new opportunities. One industry embracing AI is the publishing field. Our goal is to help ordinary writers become extraordinary authors, said Tim McConaughey, the founder of Salt Lake-based Izzard, Inc. Publishing. It's publishing an industry that's ripe for digitization. Izzard, Inc. publishes about 12 titles each year. McConaughey is using AI to help streamline the publishing process. AI has hit every aspect of our business, he said. From the minute a manuscript comes in, we sit down and we assess it. We assess it with AI, and more importantly, we assess it with human editors. McConaughey made it clear that artificial intelligence isn't writing books. Instead, it creates efficiencies. It's helping us identify what the problems are, he said. It's giving us solutions, and it's helping authors know what to change and how to change it. It's creating better content. McConaughey isn't alone in his use of AI. According to a recent survey by Goldman Sachs, 10,000 Small Business Voices, 58% of small businesses nationwide plan to invest in artificial intelligence in 2024. Our small businesses are going to need resources and technical expertise to adopt AI so they can continue to compete, said Janetta King, with the Goldman Sachs 10,000 Small Businesses program. The program is lobbying lawmakers at the federal level to add more AI tools and training to existing resources like small business development centers. Our small businesses are looking at AI through the lens of productivity and efficiency, King said. They can do more. They can serve their customers and clients better. As artificial intelligence continues to grow, McConaughey encourages other small business owners to learn about the tech and embrace it to improve results. We have to understand the processes behind what we are doing, or AI will lead us astray. That's why training the workforce is more important, he said. We are seeing the businesses that employ the workforce that knows AI. They are going to succeed. Our next article is titled, How Trump's Reciprocal Tariffs Plan Could Affect Businesses and Your Wallet. Trump administration officials insist the plan promotes fairness and U.S. job growth. Dated February 14, 2025. A new plan signed by President Donald Trump is ushering in more uncertainty surrounding tariffs and the potential impact on what U.S. consumers pay for goods. The president unveiled the plan that will enact so-called reciprocal tariffs. Those are import taxes imposed by the U.S. government that match tariffs or tax rates other countries place on American products. They charge us a tax or tariff, and we charge them the exact same tax or tariff. Very simple, the president said, signing a proclamation on reciprocal tariffs Thursday. Trump administration officials insist the plan promotes fairness and U.S. job growth and potentially raises revenue for the U.S. government. But some economists and industry insiders share the concern that the costs of tariffs could be passed to businesses and working families. These retaliatory tariffs come at a price for the American people, said Sara Sadwani, political science professor at Pomona College. Rhett Buttle, founder and CEO of Public-Private Strategies, also believes the proposed reciprocal tariffs could lead to higher costs for businesses. That's because many of the businesses do rely on foreign products, he said. This creates a challenge and a cost that businesses may have to pass on to consumers. Colin Graybaugh, the associate director at the Cato Institute's Herbert A. Stifel Center for Trade Policy Studies, told Scripps News he's skeptical of the administration's arguments that reciprocal tariffs will benefit U.S. manufacturers. I think there's certainly a reason to prepare, to give some thought, to think this isn't just an idle threat or idle chit-chat, Graybaugh said. I think the president has demonstrated time and time again that he is a tariff enthusiast. In the case of auto production, for example, Graybaugh said manufacturers are so heavily reliant on imported goods, if those prices go up, that's going to make them less competitive, he said. Instead of raising tariffs, Graybaugh suggests the opposite, and trying to reduce our tariffs, reducing our fair and trade barriers, and making the United States a low-cost, more competitive place to do business, he said. Buttle points to another potential challenge ahead. It could lead to businesses facing supply chain disruptions because they'll have to potentially search for alternative suppliers or other domestic options. The president himself addressed a certain level of uncertainty. Nobody really knows what is going to happen, he said, other than we know that jobs are going to be produced at levels that we haven't seen before. There is no single figure or percentage to put on these tariffs, because the tariff increases will be customized for each country, potentially triggering trade negotiations with a number of nations. Administration officials have been tasked with creating a report for the president on which countries should be targeted and the rates to apply. That report is expected to be in the president's hands by April 1st. Our next article is titled, Denver Reuse Business Directory Highlights Places to Repair, Rent, or Buy Used Items Across the Denver Metro. This directory is one way the City of Denver is working to reduce consumption, waste, and pollution. Dated February 14, 2025. The City of Denver's Climate Action, Sustainability, and Resiliency Office works to reduce consumption, waste, and pollution within the city. As part of that goal, CASR aims to create a circular economy centered around sharing, repairing, recycling, and reusing materials. One way CASR is working to implement a zero-waste circular economy focuses on educating Denverites on how to use less and waste less by visiting local resale, repair, and rental businesses, according to a CASR spokesperson. Recently, the Denver Reuse Business Directory was launched to support that effort. It's a list and interactive map that displays local businesses throughout the metro that repair, rent, or buy used items. The fact that they even made the reuse directory says something about the certain ambitions of the city, said Chris Scott, Director of Operations at Recreative Denver. Recreative Denver is one of the stores listed in the directory. The nonprofit has a number of different features, including an art gallery currently featuring upcycled art by Elizabeth Morissette, studio rental spaces for several artists, and a community wood shop. But the backbone of their business model is collecting donated art supplies and selling them for a fraction of the cost. It's like Goodwill for the arts and crafts supplies, Scott said. We don't take stuff that I think we can't use. We can give more or less a guarantee that we will get these supplies into the hands of the people that can use them. The art supplies at Recreative Denver can range from textiles to paints to origami paper, something Scott found for a customer on Thursday afternoon. You'd be astonished at what people are willing to throw away, said Scott, who has been with Recreative since it first began in 2016. Kelly Eigenberger is the program director for Recreative Denver. She plans classes, manages social media, and arranges volunteer and gallery events, in addition to throwing pottery in one of the studio rental spaces. Working here is so fun. And I'm a little raccoon. I get to dig through other people's stuff and often find, like, really interesting things, Eigenberger said, about sorting through the art supply donations. She then loves watching those items be transformed into something meaningful for customers and friends. Seeing my friends succeed in a fashion show because they get most of their material here, Eigenberger said, as an example of how art supplies can be used. Or kids at Metropolitan State University, or DU, or wherever able to afford the really obscure and expensive oil painting colors. The stuff that we get ranges from your grandma's sewing room to brand new, unopened, really high-quality material. Another nonprofit on the reuse business directory is Denver Tool Library, which functions like a library for a variety of tools. You can come and borrow tools to take home and work on your project, or you can come work on your project here in the open shop. And if you don't know how to do your project yet, you can take classes with us, explains Sarah Steiner, the founder and executive director of the Denver Tool Library. Steiner said the Denver Tool Library 10 years ago, after seeing a similar concept in Nova Scotia and deciding Denver needed one too. We started out really small and scrappy, and I guess we're still scrappy, but we've gotten bigger and we can offer a lot more services to Denver, which feels really good, said Steiner. By being a part of a community where people are interested in and willing to repair tools instead of just throw them away, it's huge. Steiner said members join the Denver Tool Library for $150 and borrow tools for a year. It's really cool to have one central place that you can go and look and see your options to borrow or reuse instead of buying new, Steiner said about the directory. According to CASR, the Denver reuse businesses within the directory employed roughly 3,000 people and contributed $540 million to the economy in 2023. Our next article is titled, Lava Island Opens in Billings, Brings Relief Inspired by Family's Cancer Journey. The first location is in Aurora, Colorado, where Henderson's met the Duncan family. Dated February 16, 2025. On Saturday, Lava Island in Billings, Montana, opened to hundreds of people looking for an indoor experience among the cold weather. It's indoors, which is great for the crazy winters and sometimes the really smoky summers, said Miranda Duncan, co-general manager. Celeste Henderson, who co-owns the business with her husband, Boyd Henderson, gave MTN a tour of the facility, which includes a trampoline area, a multi-level jungle gym, and private party rooms. A lot of parents have expressed to us that they're glad to have a spot to get together for parties that isn't their house, said Celeste. Billings Lava Island is the second location for the business. The first location is in Aurora, Colorado, where the Hendersons met the Duncan family. While we were in Denver for my son's cancer treatment, we actually ended up spending a lot of time at Lava Island and befriended the owners, said James Duncan, Miranda's husband and business other general co-manager. The Duncan family said the Colorado branch of the business gave them a way to find relief amid their son's Nathan's leukemia treatment. We really struggled with all of the challenges that he was facing as a 9-year-old, but also all of the challenges our 6-year-old daughter was facing as well, said Miranda. Despite officially opening on Saturday, the Duncan family has been part of the process for 2 years, initially suggesting the former Billings Sportsplex for the new indoor play center. We've designed the play structure so every level is 7 feet high, said James. We've designed it in a way that families can play together. The two said they are excited to share the same fun they have experienced at Lava Island with Billings families. Every family has their own challenges. Everybody goes through big things and little things, said James. Miranda and James would like to thank the Henderson family for bringing Lava Island to Billings and recognize their kids for giving them the strength to work long hours when opening the business. Our next article is titled, Private Company Outlook, Talent Development, by Deloitte Private. For private company leaders, talent development has become a top business priority for the next 12 months. From leadership succession prep to apprenticeship and mentoring, private enterprises are not only focused on implementing employee development programs, but doing so in a way that increases employee engagement and productivity. Many of the preeminent priorities among private companies are talent-centric, ranging from enhancing employee productivity to developing and establishing new leadership. says Wolf Tone, vice chair of Deloitte LLP and U.S. Deloitte private leader. Investments in talent development are the cornerstone of fostering an engaged and collaborative workforce while ensuring an organization remains competitive and is poised to adapt in the future. Some organizations are opting for in-office initiatives, while others are leveraging hybrid work-friendly technology. Regardless of their approach, our latest survey of 100 private company executives highlights the critical importance of talent development strategies. Leaders are being developed from within. The top three business priorities for private enterprises: productivity, 36%, leadership succession, 33%, and hiring talent, 32%. Therefore, more than 7 out of 10 private company executives expect their organization's use of apprenticeship or mentoring programs to increase in the next 12 months. The desired outcome? Engaged, productive employees. Employee engagement and productivity emerge as an important outcomes of talent development programs. Despite recognizing the implementation challenges, 73% of surveyed private company leaders expect investments in these programs to increase over the next year. Company size influences talent development tactics. Larger, higher revenue private companies emphasize in-person connection for their talent development programs. Meanwhile, smaller, lower revenue companies invest in technology that supports collaboration and productivity to accommodate hybrid work environments. Our next article is titled "Award-Winning Chef Serving Up Fresh Oysters in Aurora," dated February 15, 2025. Colorado is likely not the first place that comes to mind when you want to enjoy fresh seafood, but there's a spot in Aurora that's bound to change your mind. In fact, the bar on the third floor of Stanley Marketplace is one of the best in the nation. Traveling Mercies is a 2025 James Beard semifinalist in the Best Bar category. We wanted to create a place that was inspired by places we like to travel, said co-owner and chef Caroline Glover. She and her husband are not newbies when it comes to creating fine dining experiences. After they opened Annette in the Stanley Marketplace, she won a regional James Beard Award in 2022 for her work there. A little over a year ago, the marketplace had a 400 square foot space available, and Caroline felt the pull to try something new. "It just felt right to do something up here," said Glover. "Well, I really loved tiny hole-in-the-wall places that you can just pop in and kind of feel like you're transported somewhere else." So they opened Traveling Mercies, a cocktail and oyster bar where you can have a drink and eat fresh seafood. Glover said historically it isn't that unusual for a landlocked state like Colorado. Denver used to be the oyster spot, because when the train would take oysters from the West Coast all the way through to the East Coast, this used to be the hub where a lot of people got oysters because they were the freshest here, said Glover. She said some were lean times after openings. "It was really hit or miss up here, just because you're not on the first floor where people are looking automatically," said Glover. "All of that has changed. Traveling Mercies is a semifinalist for a James Beard Award in a national category." "I was giddy. It was such a surprise," shared Glover. She said business has picked up and, while she appreciates it, she said what she loves the most is the experience she gives her customers. "I had somebody actually last night eating sardines and having a beer, and she said, 'I'm transported back 20 years when I was a college student and in Spain, drinking cheap beer and eating sardines,'" said Glover. James Beard Award winners will be announced at a ceremony on Monday, June 16th in Chicago. Our next article is titled, "Colorado's Large Medical Research Community Deals with Attempts to Cut Federal Funding," dated February 14, 2025. Colorado's medical research community is looking at how to handle the potential of cuts to research grant money that it receives from the National Institutes of Health. The Trump administration has moved to cut millions of dollars in spending, but a judge acting on a lawsuit has put a temporary stop to the action. "We've been watching these executive orders as they come out. seeing how that may apply to our researchers and then responding as appropriately, said Dr. Thomas Flagg, Vice Chancellor for Research at the University of Colorado Anschutz Medical Campus. Records show in 2024, NIH awards for CU Denver, including Anschutz, were providing nearly $350 million. The National Institutes of Health is the largest sponsor of the work at Anschutz. Research at Anschutz is financed in a mix of federal, state, pharmaceutical, and private dollars. Flagg says about 1,500 people lead individual grants conducting medical research from the NIH, with thousands of employed in supporting and helping with that research. There are orders involving research that CU Anschutz is doing that may be inclusive of DEI initiatives that have been the subject of stop work orders. The university says it is looking at legal ramifications of those orders. Work under NIH grants is highly competitive, with researchers competing to win grants and succeeding about a fifth of the time. Explaining research and its many aspects has always been a challenge. Some has a greater likelihood of failure, but thinking more out of the box can lead to greater breakthroughs. If every trial you're doing is positive, you're not doing risky enough or daring enough trials to make change, said Flagg, who has grants to research bladder cancer. For the most part, the cuts ordered by the Trump administration would mean a significant reduction in what is called indirect costs, which are provided for infrastructure and other aspects of running facilities to conduct research. There's biomedical waste, there's chemical waste, we are very careful about those sorts of things. There's data storage needs, there's security around data storage. So it's really a rather elaborate infrastructure that's required to do this research, and it's expensive to fund that, said Flagg. We think it will be a $74 million impact for the calendar year, as best we can estimate right now. The cuts would mean a cap on the percentage of money set aside for indirect costs at 15%. Some institutions have much higher percentages, which is based on a formula calculated by the government, which takes into consideration things like the level of research and need for facilities and where they are located in the country. On his social media platform X, Elon Musk, leader of the White House's Department of Government Efficiency, called higher rates received by universities a ripoff. You need a facility to do this in. Facilities for research are expensive and have very sophisticated environments around those. If that infrastructure is not fully funded, you'll need to take funds from other areas to cover that, said Flagg. He noted, however, that it may be time to discuss indirect costs, but not abruptly. A broad discussion about how we do this. How do we mix private industry and federal together in a way that makes sense? I think that's a very fair conversation to have over time. The Colorado Attorney General has joined 21 other attorneys general in suing, and early this week, a federal judge granted a temporary restraining order to a temporary halt the move by the administration to make the cuts. Legally, there are questions about doing what Congress seems to have specified prohibited. The Trump administration also tried to cut NIH money for research in Trump's first term in 2018. Congress rejected the idea of cuts to indirect costs and even added language into subsequent bills prohibiting cuts in money devoted for indirect costs. Our next article is titled, Denver Urban Spectrum Readers Are Grateful to Be, dated February 14, 2025. Every month, Denverites look forward to reading the Denver Urban Spectrum. For 37 years, the publication has been dedicated to spreading the news about people of color. Co-founder and publisher Rosalind B. Harris is preparing to pass the torch for this Denver institution. It's hard to imagine Denver without the Urban Spectrum. Harris recalls designing the first issue in 1987. I checked with the printer. It's going to cost $1,100 to print. The publication went out. We got $1,102 worth of advertising, and that's how it started. We didn't know what we were doing, said Harris, who started her career as a graphic designer. I just knew that I could lay it out, and quite frankly, I've been fortunate enough to do that every month for the last 37 years, added Harris. If people were talking about it, the urban spectrum was documenting it. Rising awareness of the AIDS epidemic, for example. We put condoms in half of the publications, said Harris. AIDS was running rampant as well, and especially in the black community. Putting a face on domestic violence in a March 1999 issue portraying a woman in a wheelchair. It resonated with people, and people needed to see those stories so that if they were suffering, that they could get help, Harris said. Recording the 1993 Summer of Violence embodied in the story of young Broderick Bell. He was 6 years old. He peeked up to see if everything was okay. And that's when the bullet hit him right in his head, right in the middle, said Harris. And the impact of giants such as Colorado State Representative Wilma Webb and marathoner philanthropist Essie Garrett. We have stories. The stories need to be told. The history needs to be recorded, said Harris. Evolving to digital and video podcasting, Harris is handing the reins at Urban Spectrum to editor Ruby Jones. She's taking it by storm. She is learning everything that I have learned over the past 37 years in the last several months, added Harris. After 4 decades of empowering and lifting others, B. Harris has made her mark, and the Denver Urban Spectrum's loyal readers are thankful. B. Harris is not done working, though. She will now focus on growing the Ruth Boyd Elder Abuse Foundation, named in honor of her late mother. It aims to ensure the safety and care of aging adults.
Enjoy the Morning After Grace world premiere. This audio-described performance will be held on Sunday, February 23rd at 2 p.m. at Miner's Alley Playhouse, located at 1103 Arapaho Street in Golden. For tickets, call the box office at 303-935-3044. Again, that is 303-935-3044.
If you enjoyed this program, please register for our free services at www.aftersight.org or by calling 303-786-7777.